right. We'll next move to the third case of the day, Robert Taylor against Ricky Hughes and others, appeal number 20-2377. Ms. Dimkar, when you're ready.
May it please the court. I'm Irene Dimkar and I represent Robert Taylor. There were cross motions here for summary judgment. The court allowed and granted defendants three successive summary judgment motions and denied plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. Plaintiff is asking that this court reverse the decision below. I'd like to start with constructive possession. There's no probable cause to arrest Robert Taylor for constructive possession of a firearm. He spent 4 months in jail awaiting trial. He was charged as an armed habitual criminal. He lost his job, his apartment, he lost everything. And it's important to know some facts here about the raid. The police raid took place at 6 a.m. in the morning. The police found in bedroom number two, this is the diagram that the police drew, bedroom number two, five people in bed, two adults, Mario Barnes and Barbara Taylor, and their three children, ages 16, 10, and 7. Mario Barnes was on parole. In bedroom number two was Barnes's safe. It was unlocked. And inside the safe was a blue steel Glock 9mm semi-automatic pistol.
It was unlocked and open, too, wasn't it? Isn't that what the evidence
yes.
was?
Yes, yes. There was no one in bedroom number one, but all the personal property for Robert Taylor was in bedroom number one. Taylor was not home at the time. The police were told that. They were told that Taylor had not been there at the home since the afternoon the day before. The sergeant overseeing the raid, Kevin Johnson, said he didn't think there was probable cause to arrest anybody, and he didn't know that an investigative alert was going to be issued. Officer Ricky Hughes testified he didn't have probable cause to arrest Barnes or Barbara Taylor because he never saw them in possession of a weapon. So the irony is obvious. He didn't think he has probable cause to arrest the people who were in the room with the gun, including someone who was on parole, but then for sure he didn't have probable cause to arrest Taylor, who was not home and had no control over Barnes' bedroom. The court said the evidence of constructive possession was thin. The court said there's no evidence of Taylor's specific control over the bedroom with the gun, but the court pointed to two things, just two things. Number one, that Taylor lived in the apartment. He said that's some circumstantial evidence that he knew something about the gun. And number two, that the safe was unlocked, and that put him in constructive possession. The defendants make the same argument, that he lived in the apartment and the safe was unlocked.
Ms. Dimkar, you, yes, on this argument in your briefing, you rely fairly heavily on federal case law of constructive possession, but the probable cause here in the arrest warrant was based on Illinois constructive possession, and Illinois courts have interpreted constructive possession a little differently than the federal courts. So why should we rely on your arguments with respect to federal law when this is an Illinois statute they had probable cause or they're arguing probable cause for?
Your Honor, I think that both federal and state law apply here. The issue is probable cause.
Why would federal law apply when they were executing a state warrant? He was charged state with possession, and the Illinois courts really have construed constructive possession differently than I read what the federal courts have done.
Your Honor, I believe it's both laws because...
Why would federal law apply then if you're arguing for that?
Because the issue is probable cause, and so and the probable cause issue would also engage federal law. If you're talking about the elements of the crime, it would be state law. First of all, I'd like to talk about Robert Taylor living in the apartment. And what it's important was he was not even home during the raid. And there's no proof that he was ever in the apartment at the same time that that gun was in the safe. There's no proof at all of that. He never knew anything about a gun in Barnes's safe in Barnes's bedroom. There's no proof.
Ms. Dimkar, I think you're making a fair point on the straight up probable cause. I have a similar question to Judge St. Eve. Let me just state it a little bit differently. Why is there no qualified immunity given the state of Illinois law that the district court discussed? In other words, why is Judge Shah's reasoning at Appendix A2, pages 20 and 21, why does that reflect legal error on the qualified immunity issue?
Well, the qualified immunity issue requires that a reasonable officer would not have reasonably believed the probable cause existed.
Right, that's the test that Judge Shaw stated, and then he talks about Illinois case law, right, that people may be found in constructive possession even when they, even when others have more direct access to an item that's recovered. I think that's, I think your primary argument you're right about. I think that what you need to persuade at least me of is the is that the qualified immunity analysis in the district court opinion reflects a legal error.
Well, we believe it's a legal error because of the, if I could just flip to the factual basis is that he lived in the apartment and that the safe was open. He's not there at the time, and there's no, he has no connection.
That's the same argument that was made to the district court, and the district court came back at you and said, it's not that I don't understand it, it's that you face the following precedent under Illinois law and found qualified immunity on the basis of that state law precedent.
Your Honor, I think that the state law is similar enough to say that mere residency is not enough. You need something else.
But the Illinois Appellate Court has said the opposite, that habitation in the premises where contraband is discovered is sufficient evidence of control to constitute constructive possession. So for the qualified immunity analysis, there has to be, if there's arguable probable cause, then qualified immunity would apply. Given that very broad definition, which I think federal law is different, but given that very broad definition or construction that Illinois courts have given it, why wouldn't that apply here?
I think that no reasonable officer would have thought under these circumstances that there was probable cause. If you mere residency, you need something else. You need some kind of a plus factor. You need access. You need knowledge. You need connection with the location. You need connection with the contraband. You need something else, not just that this was your apartment and you're not there. And there's no proof that he was there at the same time.
What about the information from the John Doe? Would that have been enough to tip it for probable cause purposes or qualified immunity under probable cause?
Well, first of all, what John Doe said, John Doe was talking about a different gun.
Different
if
gun,
it happened,
right.
I mean, Robert Taylor denies that was true. But if it happened, he's talking about a different gun. There's no connection between the gun the informant said he saw and the blue steel semi-automatic in the safe. We also question the John Doe's veracity, his reliability, his veracity, and the information he had. And so some of the issues in this case kind of overlap. We think that there's no way that Ricky Hughes should have believed this John Doe informant. We don't even know who he is.
Thank you. That was my question. Did did any evidence come out? I didn't see it. So did any evidence come out about John Doe and who he was? I know there was evidence that Officer Hughes met him for the first time, that another officer had said, talk to him, he was a CI. But beyond that, do we know anything about John Doe or his relationship to Mr. Taylor? I didn't see it.
Absolutely not. And that's a big problem. And that goes into the issue about the good faith exception to the particularity requirement. But John Doe just dropped out of the sky. Nobody knew who he was. Ricky Hughes said, Detective Weitzman handed him off to me. Weitzman said, that never happened. I never talked to an informant, and I never talked to Ricky Hughes. So there's an informant is there, and Ricky Hughes talks to him for 20 minutes. We don't have his notes. He destroyed his notes. He destroyed the criminal history. He destroyed the photographic array. We don't know. We don't know anything about the John Doe. I think going to your question, Judge St. Eve, what information did he have? What was his relationship with Robert Taylor? How many times had he gone to this house? And why would a 40-year-old man pull out a gun and say, see what I got? You know, someone who's been through the prison system, that was in his past. But, you know, a teenager does that. A 40-year-old person doesn't do that. I mean, there were things that just didn't add up with him saying there's a gun there on the south side. And the circumstances, of course, of how this informant appeared. It was in the middle of a chaotic situation. This was a roundup after months of investigation of drug dealers in the north side, the far north side. And somehow there is this person, we don't even know who he is, that appears out of nowhere. No one seems to vouch for him. No one vetted him. He's just there.
Was he charged in connection with that roundup on the north side, or we don't know?
We don't know. We don't know. That's the problem. If we had his criminal history, we might be able to tell. But we don't know. I suspect that he was there for a reason. He was there because he was part of the roundup, and for some reason he wanted to gain favor with the police. We don't know what his motive is, but I'm saying circumstantially he's there at the same time as people are being arrested, dozens of arrest warrants are being prepared for this drug investigation on the north side. And all of a sudden there's this informant coming out of nowhere saying, I know about a gun on the south side. And Ricky Hughes, his hapless creature, hapless officer, he was just, someone just gave him the informant and he talked to the informant. He didn't know anything. And that should have been told to the judge. The judge should have been told, I don't know this person and I don't know anything about him.
He may have been, right? We don't know in what happened with the judge because it happened in the car and wasn't recorded.
Right, right.
It wasn't in the application for the search warrant.
Right, right. So
Ms. Dimkar,
yes.
I apologize, but given our limited time, there's one issue. Would you mind if I switch you on an issue?
Please.
To get the benefit of your reaction to this?
Please.
Okay. It's on the December false arrest.
Yes.
And specifically the defendant, Detective Weitzman. Okay. The district court determined that Detective Weitzman was entitled to qualified immunity. You argue that was improper because there are material facts that remained unresolved that remain with respect to his role. What exactly are the unresolved material facts?
Well,
what don't you know that you think creates a jury issue?
Our argument is a little bit more elaborate than that because we say that qualified immunity does not apply to an issue such as causation. It's clear that his constitutional rights were violated. His constitutional right to be arrested.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but causation doesn't come under qualified immunity. It's a factual issue. Did he cause it to happen? And the judge, to begin with, the district court said that. I'm sorry. You were going to.
No. Well, here's just to go right to the bottom line. Okay. Is I spent a lot of time in the deposition testimony, okay, comparing, contrasting, all that. But as I read Detective Joshua Weitzman's deposition testimony at page 142, he testified that he never received knowledge after the June arrest. He didn't receive knowledge of the June arrest, okay? Now, if that's credited, right, if we take that as, unless the defendant joins issue with it, I don't know how there's any basis for liability with respect to the December false arrest. In other words, how is it that he engaged in intentional misconduct that would have committed this constitutional violation if he wouldn't have even had knowledge of the June arrest and therefore didn't even know to pull down the investigative alert?
He's responsible for monitoring an investigative alert that he creates. He created, he knew he started the ball rolling, and given the causation issue is an issue for the jury. If you start the ball rolling, are you supposed to expect someone else to stop the ball rolling?
Okay, and who testified that he shoulders that affirmative ongoing monitoring obligation?
It's in the special order. That he is the detective, so he's qualified to enter it into the
yeah. As a matter of authority, I have no doubt about that, but I read the totality of the testimony to be that someone in the Bureau of Investigative Services, like Detective Weitzman, has to be informed that there was an arrest and therefore in a position to know to pull down the investigative alert.
Your Honor, I think that this is this kind of goes hand in hand with our issue regarding the investigative alert and our Monell claim with the city. We're saying that if no individual, if responsibility is so diffuse within the police department, you have so many people involved here. This person's looking over this. This person's looking over this, but no one takes a responsibility.
Yeah, I understand that. But we're talking about individual liability here, and to send Detective Weitzman to a trial, right? Don't you need more than even if there is a duty to monitor, more than negligence on his part?
Your Honor, I think the issue of causation is an issue for the jury. Whether when if you put an investigative alert into the computer, that's equivalent of a warrant, and then do nothing to monitor it, and do nothing to follow it as it goes through, I think that that's a problem. But I do, I've run out of time, but I did want to talk about the investigative alert and the Monell claim, because this may be the situation where the Monell claim and the city's responsibility is even more enhanced. Because if everybody says, I don't know who, I didn't want him to be arrested, I didn't ask for the investigative alert, there's no sign who put it into the computer, why it was put into the computer. Hughes says, I never asked for an investigative alert. Weitzman says, I must have been asked by Hughes. Nobody seems to know how it got into the system. And then there is no audit system at all for either purging or to audit the investigative alerts. And this is exactly the kind of situation that was the court just talked about in Glisson. It's a highly predictable consequence that constitutional rights are going to be violated. There are drawers of these, thousands of these investigative alerts that no one's paying any attention to, and there's no mechanism. It's just like Glisson. There's no protocol for canceling the investigative alerts, and the city just doesn't care. When they decided to change the investigative alert order in 2001, they created something where nothing was going to happen automatically. You had to take a person coming in to audit. And that hasn't happened. We did also mention that this Sergeant Hatula, the computer person, says you can link the databases.
I think we've got your point on that from the briefs and from your argument. You'll have a brief rebuttal.
Okay.
And we'll hear from the defendants.
Thank you,
at
Your
this
Honor.
Point.
I appreciate that.
Okay, from Ms. Luce.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'll start where my opposing counsel just left off with the Monell claims. Taylor argues that his arrests in December are attributable to two municipal policies. We submit that neither claim works here. And I think it's important to clarify a few things about the record. It is simply not true that the special order that governs investigative alerts authorizes or allows for an investigative alert to arrest somebody without probable cause. It's not allowed under the special order, and it's not what happened here. Under the special order, you always have to justify a request for an alert, and every single one is to be labeled either with or without probable cause.
Well, it is what happened here in December.
I'm sorry?
It is what happened here in December. He was arrested without probable cause in December. You said this is not what happened here, and I think you have to distinguish between June and December.
Well, I think that what I'm trying to, I agree, in December, the probable cause had dissipated. But the policy argument is based on the idea that my opposing counsel has painted the picture that no one is accepting responsibility for even determining probable cause. And that is
no, what she was focusing on was removing an investigative alert after the events of the summer and the fall.
Right.
And that's, I don't see anybody taking responsibility for that.
Well, what happened in this case is that, I understand her to be arguing about two policies, about there not even being a requirement of probable cause, and that there's a problem with the audits, that there's an implied policy of no audits. And for an implied policy under Monell, the plaintiff must show something, usually a pattern or practice to alert municipal policymakers. I mean, there's something that went awry here. But
this is an utterly predictable consequence of not conducting audits, right?
I don't necessarily agree with that for a couple reasons. For one reason is because if things are done correctly on the front end, then this won't happen. The audit isn't the only insurance under the special order. There's actually a chain of communication that is written out in the special order that requires first, you know, the field officer is required to notify the detective unit, and then when that's reported to the hot desk at the detective unit, then that unit is responsible to respond, conduct follow-up investigation, and to ensure that a supervisor is notified in the event that an investigative alert is to be updated or canceled. Now, so that policy instructs supervisors to update or cancel as necessary, and you can even see in the work logs that are in the record at R93-2 that there is a system, there's this log where the boxes are checked when the field officers call in about who is notified, and you go all the way across to check the box for whether the alert is to be canceled. So there is no evidence that between the chain of communication and then the auditing that did occur, that others were arrested without probable cause. And of course, you know, the fact that audits weren't conducted every 28 days doesn't show that whatever was going on was so obvious that policymakers knew what was going on.
Counsel, it was 6 months later, right? Second arrest was 6 months after the first one implementing the investigative alert. So whatever auditing was going on, it wasn't enough to catch this in 6 months, right?
Yes.
That's a reasonable inference.
Right. Something went awry for sure in this case. But that is not enough to show a policy, from the city policymakers.
There's also evidence that there were virtually no audits. Taking the evidence in the light most favorable to plaintiff.
There is an evidence that there were audits, that they were not every 28 days. And that would be the backup to the communication requirements in the ordinance.
Could I ask you about the June 28 and probable cause for the June 28 arrest?
Yes.
Probable cause for which gun?
Well, we would submit there's probable cause for, first of all, the gun that Doe saw him in possession of that he.
So you think there was probable cause to arrest somebody where there's no gun and no witness that you can find?
Well, there was probable cause based on Doe, who was a witness who saw him in possession of the gun the day before.
But you know, by the 28th, do we know who Doe is?
By the 28th, Officer Hughes knew who Doe was at the time. He did not know by the time of his
deposition. Didn't know where to find him?
But this is not a case
Did he know where to find him?
Did he know where to find him at the time of his deposition? No, but this is not a case where the warrant judge relied on just the officer's testimony about Doe. Doe actually came in and testified to the warrant judge.
Sorry, we're talking about the arrest, not the search warrant.
Right. Well, the arrest occurred after the search, but the probable cause stemmed from the communication.
Okay, so you think there's no probable cause for the semi-automatic?
There's arguable probable cause for that as well.
That too?
Yes. A reasonable officer could believe that that was the gun because...
Even though all the officers agreed there was no probable cause for any of the five people in the room with the gun.
Well, the five people in the room with the gun were in proximity to the gun, but none of them had been seen in possession of a gun. A reasonable officer could presume it's the same gun that the Doe had seen a few days before.
I beg your pardon? The same gun?
A reasonable officer could conclude that, yes.
But the witness couldn't tell the difference between a revolver and a blue steel semi-automatic?
Perhaps, yes. But even more important, there was probable cause even just based on what the John Doe had seen several days before.
Ms. Luce, can I ask you another question on the warrant, the warrant execution? I want you to assume for purposes of the question, I know you disagree as a matter of fact, but assume that the record shows an intentional misrepresentation by Officer Hughes in the warrant application, the search warrant application, akin to a Franks violation. where the remedy in a criminal case would be suppression of the evidence, regardless of the good faith of the officers who then executed the warrant. As for Hughes, if we assume that there's an intentional misrepresentation, why should he receive qualified immunity, or why should any good faith, if we want to think about it that way, in the execution be allowed to cure the prior bad act at the procurement stage?
Well, for an absolute intentional misrepresentation, perhaps not, but that's one thing. In this case, what we have is at most a negligence, a disregard.
I don't know how you can say that, with all respect. I honestly don't. I mean, I've looked at it hard. One S was made up out of thin air.
Well, I understand but I would say,
well, if you understand that, that's an intentional misrepresentation. You have an officer going to a state court judge. In the Fourth Amendment context, when you're talking about searches, you know this as well as anybody, there's two P's that are really important: place and probability. And when you go and you say, we're asking for permission to search 1S, and 1S is made up, that's a problem.
1S was not, I would submit, though, it's different than an intentional lie. It was a faulty deduction based on what.
What about reckless disregard?
How about the drugs? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to get to both of those topics. I was going to get to drugs. What about reckless disregard? So to pick up on what Judge Scudder was asking, you're saying, well, that's not intentional. Well, how can it not be reckless disregard? He admitted he made up the address.
Well, I see.
And you're arguing, well, that's negligence. But can we say, as a matter of law, when the officer who completed the search warrant admitted that he guesstimated, that that's not reckless disregard?
Well, I would say it doesn't amount to reckless disregard or an intentional lie, because he didn't have the truth stare him in the face. There was nothing.
But he could have followed up. He could have done a leads search. He could have done something. It was within his power,
and yet,
to quickly confirm what the address was, and he didn't do anything.
And yet there's no evidence that had he done any of those things, that would have confirmed that was
the
purpose of the burden.
Aren't they trained to not make up facts?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, come on.
But of course they're not supposed to make up facts.
All he had to do was say, Your Honor, I have no idea what apartment it is, but I can describe it in meticulous detail.
Well, he felt he could make a reasonable deduction based on what he did know about the signage and the apartment building.
You say reasonable deduction. It's actually not what he testified to. He testified in substance, I made it up.
He testified that he chose the 645. He got to the right building, of course, and he chose the 645, assuming that it was, you know, attached to, there were some windows on the right side that were identified as Taylor's apartment. And there were also some windows on the left side that were recessed a little bit back. So his assumption about 645 is,
how do you explain his asking for permission to search for drugs when there's not one fact in the fact pattern that has anything to do with drugs?
It was just based on the general notion that firearms and drugs and his background as a
isn't that request relevant to the reckless disregard intentional misrepresentation issue?
Well, he didn't disregard which apartment number it was, and also it was a.
But is it that wasn't the question? Was just a little bit different, Ms. Luce. He specifically requests to search for any paraphernalia, any drugs, weighing, cutting, mixing of illegal drugs, and there is nothing in the affidavit and his statement that would support that he had any probable cause that drugs were in the apartment. So isn't the fact that he's asking for that something that's relevant to the qualified immunity issue and the reckless disregard in obtaining the warrant in the first instance?
Well, maybe that aspect, but he did have information about an illegal gun in the apartment, and also the search warrant itself would be upheld, if it turns out it's reasonable.
So you've said that maybe that aspect if it is maybe that aspect, how can qualified immunity be given as a matter of law, given that the fact that he's asking for drugs when there's nothing to support probable cause for drugs? Wouldn't that go directly to misrepresentations or reckless disregard?
Well,
especially when you have a John Doe who, you said he knew who John Doe was. He met John Doe that day and based his reliability on the fact that he thought he was telling the truth. That's not what John Doe's in search warrants, that's not what reliability is based on under the law.
Well, John Doe's are. You can rely on a John Doe that you haven't known before. And a significant reason to do that is when you have sufficient details and what they tell you about what they saw and where they saw it and can identify.
See, that's where in a lot of places in your argument, you make legal observations that are correct. They're not supported factually. So if you say, if an officer takes care and acts diligently and does responsible pre-warrant work, you can rely upon a John Doe. Of course. It's not what happened here.
Well, if there's no evidence that he didn't rely properly on the John Doe.
Evidence is there that the John Doe was reliable?
Well, the John Doe testified before a warrant judge and whose determination of probable cause is entitled to some presumption.
We have no idea what was told to that judge in the back of the car. By the way, is that typical to do something like that in a car transcript?
Well, the officers are finding judges when they need them in urgent situations where
it just struck me as odd.
If I could follow up though on this, if this were a Franks hearing in a criminal case, the fact that the judge signed a warrant approving a search for drugs and drug evidence on this application would offer a pretty strong argument the judge was a rubber stamp. And that takes you out of Leon and the good faith exception in the criminal context. What's wrong with my interpretation of that?
I don't know that there is an argument that it's just a rubber stamp.
When the judge issues a warrant for a drug search without any mention of probable cause or evidence about drugs at all in the application?
The judge issued the warrant based on information about the firearm that John had.
Exactly.
The judge knew that there was not evidence about the drugs per se, but that
and issued a warrant to authorize a search for drugs. What police officer would think that's a lawful warrant?
One who had presented a John Doe before a judge who had every opportunity to
without any
him
evidence
about
what
he
about
saw
drugs.
Or what he, I'm sorry?
Without any evidence about drugs.
Well, we don't know if he questioned John Doe about the drugs.
Are you going to argue that maybe there was some phantom conversation about drugs in this in the unrecorded automobile conversation?
And it's an
is
affirmative
that the theory?
It's an affirmative defense. Don't you have to prove it? Qualified immunity, which this would go to.
I see that my time is run.
You can keep answering questions from the bench.
Your Honor, I mean, the plaintiff had not even really pressed this idea of the problem with the drugs in the warrant in this case.
She made the point. She didn't waive it.
And the focus on this appeal has been about whether the address was a reason to disregard the warrant. And this court has had several occasions to address cases involving mistaken addresses and warrants.
We have. None of them are comparable to this.
Well, what is clear from those is that it's not just a mistake that matters. It's a search is upheld when, despite the error in a warrant, the officers have reasonably executed the search. And here they did because Mr. Taylor was subject to a warrant, but the address in it wasn't
his. We know the warrant wasn't valid. The district court said that because it didn't specify the place. So if we go to the qualified immunity analysis, although they weren't this isn't about drugs being seized, I don't understand why that fact wouldn't be relevant to the good faith aspect of the qualified immunity. Not that it's dispositive, but it seems to raise an issue of fact that can't be decided as a matter of law.
Well, I would just submit that even with the mistake on the warrant, the search itself will be upheld if it's reasonable. And in situations like this,
if the warrant's invalid,
officers are allowed to rely on knowledge, even though you have a mistaken address in the
warrant. That might be fair as to most of those, the team of officers. I don't know how it's fair as to Officer Hughes. Because it almost seems ridiculous to say, I placed good faith on a warrant that I procured through a misrepresentation.
Well, Officer Hughes was there when Doe had pointed out the exact apartment and when Doe had identified Mr. Taylor as the subject of the warrant and when Mr. Doe had told him how to enter into the apartment. And all of these considered along, this court's cases teach that even when there is a mistaken address in the warrant,
the problem is you're in a different galaxy here. You're not even close to mistake. You really are. On this fact pattern, it's not inadvertence, it's not mistake, it's not ambiguity, it's not Muhammad, it's not, oh my word, we're up here on the first floor, it turns out there's apartment 1A and 1B. What do we do now?
No, but it is a situation where the officer made a deduction, and it was an incorrect deduction. And I submit that's not the same thing.
But he never told the judge that's what he was doing. He never told the judge, this is a deduction. I went to the apartment with John Doe. Here's how you access it. None of that was disclosed to the court.
That is true. I would submit that still he did not act in bad faith in his representations. He made a quick ill-advised deduction and then proceeded with a warrant that was based on solid knowledge that he had from Doe.
Thank you, Ms. Luce. Ms. Demkar, we'll give you 3 extra minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, regarding the John Doe, we don't know anything about him. If he's not reliable for the search warrant.
You can take your mask off.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. We're all learning and adapting.
If the John Doe is not reliable for the warrant, the John Doe is not reliable for an arrest. There's a question of whether there was a probable cause to arrest him for the revolver, given what Hughes says the John Doe informant said. If he's not reliable, he's not reliable. And it goes beyond not being reliable. He's unknown. He's an unknown person who's unreliable. We don't know anything about him, and Hughes knew nothing about him. He knew his name. We don't know even if he knew his full name or his street name. He knew a name that day, did not know a phone number, did not know an address, knew nothing about him, knew nothing about why he was pointing a finger at Robert Taylor and saying that he had a gun. He was totally, totally unreliable. So it was reckless that he didn't tell the judge. This is somebody who just dropped in, is here now because of we're in the middle of a roundup, and we don't know anything about him. So I wanted to clear that up. I also want to say something about the investigative alert. There is, with regard to the express policy, does not require probable cause. And I would say, it's something that I learned recently, the investigative alert special order has been changed and it requires probable cause now. But at the time, it did not require probable cause. There's a box that is supposed to be filled in for justification. But the detective could have said, we want to talk to him. We think he has information. It doesn't say anywhere in an express policy that there has to be probable cause. And also on the other part of the defective policy, this is not, by the way, a broken system. This is a system that was never unbroken. It was never not broken.
Can I ask you a question on that point?
Sure.
One of the things I was trying to find in the briefs is whether in discovery there was any pursuit of whether there have been other false arrests on the basis of, I don't know what you call it, like a stale investigative alert or the arrest having already happened. Was that pursued in discovery?
It was pursued. There was no information from the city, and it's very difficult to find somebody who has an investigative alert. People do not know they have investigative alerts.
No, I know, but people that are arrested a second time that says, what are you doing arresting me? I've already been arrested on this and the case is cleared. even if it didn't lead to litigation, I would have thought it maybe had led to complaints to the police department or like an inspector general's inquiry. Was any of that the subject of discovery?
It wasn't something that that we were able to find, and I don't think it's readily available. Just like you can't tell who has an investigative alert against them. You can't just say...
Sure, because it's a non-public database.
It's right, and so you know when you're arrested, but then you're more concerned about the arrest. So to try to figure out the investigative alert is difficult. The other thing I do want to say in this case was we didn't understand the enormity of the problem, of the systemic problem, until way into the litigation. There's no way we could have then said, oh, we want to make a class action, or we want to do something something like that. It just wasn't possible. But we do say that that it's highly foreseeable that there were going to be other people involved. And the fact that there were no audits, we dispute this with the city. The 30B6 witnesses, they had testified, Commander Kennedy and Sergeant O'Leary said, no audits. They can't remember there ever having been an audit. There was never an audit. And Kennedy even said, I understand there are lieutenants who are supposed to do it. I understand there's supposed to be protocol. There is no protocol. So this is directly parallel to GLSEN, where you know that you've got directives, you know you're supposed to do something, there are no protocols, and it just doesn't get done.
Ms. Dimkar, if we were to remand on the Monell claim, would you be interested in taking further discovery on those questions?
Certainly. Okay. I'd be open to. I think this is an insidious problem.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, our thanks to all counsel for your helpful presentations. The case is taken under advisement.